Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we talk to the author of a new book about the growing trend of megafires and what happens when global warming meets years of forest mismanagement. We'll also hear from Fresno City Council member Steve Brandow, who this week is introducing new legislation that, if adopted, would make it a crime to camp on public or private property in the city. We'll hear why he claims it's a necessary step to address the city's homelessness problem. We begin today's show, though, with a look at the intersection of two worlds that are often in the headlines here in Central California, technology and agriculture. It's peak harvest time throughout Central California. Crews are picking crops like peaches, grapes, and almonds. And this season, some growers are having a hard time finding enough workers for harvest. There just aren't enough people who want to work the 500,000 farm labor jobs in California. And as FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports, the ag world is looking to robots to fill this gap.
Let's face it, farmers are usually slow to change their practices for a couple reasons. Change usually comes with a high price tag. A new tractor can cost $500,000. And farmers want to minimize risk by only investing in things that have been successfully tested and in the end don't reduce profits. But robots are slowly changing that perspective.
At the end of the day, robots can go into really harsh environments where people really don't want to work. And in turn, it'll create new jobs, like the people that are actually maintaining the robots, the people that are actually programming the robots. It'll bring a whole different facet of labor pool.
That's Jason Vazano with the Fresno company Electric Motor Shop and Supply. He outfits basic robots with parts for farmers across the region. He's opening a little box at their downtown Fresno office and warehouse. Inside is a small plastic square sensor that can be attached to a machine or robot.
So here we have like photo eyes, photo sensors and stuff like that, so it tells presence, no presence. This one in particular is infrared. It's just looking for bounce back of light from the product.
Vazano says the growers he works with usually approach him with a specific need, ranging from a machine that sorts fruit to robots that can tell whether an individual piece of fruit is ripe using infrared technology. Ryan Jacobson with the Fresno County Farm Bureau says Silicon Valley's increased interest in farm robotics in places like the Central Valley couldn't have come at a more perfect time. He says as harvest ramps up, there's going to be a need for more laborers to pick crops.
There's just not the supply of individuals that there used to be. We talk about the ag economy, it's robust. It's obviously grown over the years in California. There's just less hands to do these jobs, particularly during that peak season.
Jacobson says he'd like to see robots invented that can pick stone fruit like peaches right off the tree. A company called Abundant Robotics in the Bay Area is working on just that, but for apples. The robot can tell if an apple is ripe or not, and if it is, then its suction arm picks it. Jacobson says finding a way for robots to pick tree fruit as well as people do is important because the seasonal laborer workforce can vary in size. Around 40% of the nation's ag workforce are employed by fruit and nut farms.
I can't underestimate when we talk about this technology, it's very cool, very futuristic, very opportunistic as far as what we may be able to do within the ag industry. Fact of the matter is it's also very expensive.
Jacobson says the high cost is what's preventing robots from being used across the valley. A simple robot can cost anywhere from a couple $1,000s to a more complex robot at $100,000 to $500,000. Meanwhile, the lettuce industry is already using robots to their advantage. Silicon Valley startup Blue River Technology has come up with a See and Spray machine that can do the work of 20 workers. At one time, the cost for a robot like this was several $100,000, but it's decreased in cost as new models came out. That sound is the machine being pulled over rows of lettuce in the Salinas Valley. Matt Keeley with the company says they teach the robotic tractor attachment by showing it hundreds of photos and videos.
We've given the machine the ability to learn, so it uses vision technology to see what's in the field, and then it uses what we'll call artificial intelligence to decide what to do when it can't do it perfectly, which is very much like a human brain.
To guarantee a crop, farmers overplant lettuce. The machine decides on its own what seedlings to kill with a fertilizer spray in order to leave enough room for the lettuce to grow. Keeley says this tech was born after the lettuce industry approached his company to address a growing problem.
That problem was a shortage of labor for doing things like thinning of a lettuce crop. Lee and Jorge took that on and said, hey, I think we can solve this problem, and went about creating some lettuce thinners.
There are also other lettuce thinners on the market being tested, as well as melon pickers, orange pickers, and grapevine pruners. But even though there are labor issues in the region, it's not like farmers are racing to replace their workers with robots. Here's Jason Vazana with Electric Motor Shop and Supply.
Agriculture as a whole, for robotics, from my perspective and what I've seen so far, it's coming real soon, but it's going to be a long period of time before robots are even more prevalent than human laborers.
Vazano says the large-scale rollout of robots on farms is years out. And even though the idea of robots replacing workers is slowly becoming a reality, the widespread acceptance of robots operating on farms is going to take some convincing. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Homelessness is a big problem across California, but especially in the city of Fresno. Nearly a decade ago, the city adopted a 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness. But with just over a year to go to that deadline, many people complain the problem is growing worse, or at least is becoming more evenly distributed throughout all parts of the community and more visible. Councilmember Steve Brandow is among those people. He represents Northwest Fresno's District 2 on the City Council. This Thursday, he's introducing new legislation that would effectively ban camping and the outdoor storage of camping paraphernalia in the city on both public and private property. He recently talked with Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess about the issue.
So you've submitted an ordinance that would ban camping in public places in the city of Fresno. What does that mean?
Well, really, my office has been inundated with calls for months. And I really believe it goes across the city. So when I talk with my colleagues, they're getting the same type of phone calls that I'm getting, complaints, and people in the community are getting very upset what they perceive happening in our community, which is people who are pitching tents and camping and sleeping in public and preparing food in public in some cases, bathing in public in some places. I had a complaint last week when a guy was taking a bath in a very beautiful fountain in Northwest Fresno. I saw the same thing in a fountain in downtown Fresno, eating lunch a couple days later. So bathing, preparing food, sleeping, tents. And the latest thing is probably the worst of all, people going to the restroom in public, okay? I don't know, for some reason I was not getting that complaint last year, but now I'm hearing it all the time. So this no camping ordinance is aimed at those behaviors. It's trying to say, those behaviors are unacceptable. And so I've got an ordinance coming out before council next week that tries to ban those behaviors or make them unlawful, so that if somebody wants to continually participate in them and obstinately participate in them, we have another tool where we can say, no, we don't accept that anymore. And that is what this ordinance is really all about.
Presumably, these are homeless people. I'm not thinking that these are folks that are, you know, instead of going to the mountains, are camping in public. Is that what you would assume, that these are homeless people?
Most of the complaints that we have are connected to homeless people that are doing these things. But to be honest, my ordinance itself never mentions the word homeless, because we're not targeting a person. We're targeting behaviors, or not even a type of person. We're just targeting behaviors that are unacceptable. Now, I want to look intelligent people in the eye and say, yes, it's a lot of the homeless that are doing these things, right? This isn't something that I've just thought of overnight. It really started several months ago when a group came to Fresno City Council from Chinatown, not even in my section of town, but they were saying, hey, when are you guys going to do you guys know that there's a huge problem out there? And I was thinking the whole time they were complaining, yeah, these guys are right on. This is the exact thing I'm hearing. So I started thinking about what could I do. I connected with our partners in
the homeless process, nonprofit partners, housing authority, some of those folks that are in charge of finding housing for folks. I also talked with Sergeant Dewey, the head of our homeless task force on for Fresno PD. Here's what I found, and I had to get myself educated first. So here's what I found. We have about 1,800 homeless people in Fresno. Out of the 1,800 homeless in Fresno, we've got people who are addicted and people who have mental illness. Oftentimes, they hide in the cracks and crevices of our city. And although they are endangering themselves, a lot of times the public doesn't see them. Here's what I've been told. We have about 500 or 600 people that are living a camping lifestyle. When you come up to them, they might be on some substance, but they know enough to say, I don't want your help. I don't want your services. I want to sleep in a tent in Fresno. And we have caseworkers and law enforcement that both say, hey, we have a place for you. No, I don't want the place. I want to do what I'm doing. They're smart enough. They're lucid enough. That's what they prefer. So it's about 600 people that this no camping policy would kind of target the behaviors, right? So that's really a group that we're trying to say, you know, we're not going to enable this lifestyle anymore.
What would be the penalty?
So the chief believes this is a tool that they can use on occasion when they deem it's necessary. So if they come up to somebody and somebody's agreeable and they say, hey, you can't, you know, we know you've been here for 3 days, you've got to move on. We can't have you here. This is unacceptable. That person complies. We understand. But if they're obstinate, the way some folks have been obstinate, almost like, hey, I know my rights. I can do what I want. You can't force me to take those services, and I'm going to stay here. Now the chief or code enforcement, they have a tool that says, I'm sorry, there's a new city policy. You can't do this camping stuff. And so then they would, if they resist or if they are unwilling to listen, they would take them to jail. They would take their belongings and store their belongings for them, give them a number. When you get out, go over here to this warehouse. Your belongings will be there for you. They would take them to jail. They might, Jeffrey, they might stay 24 hours. They might stay 8 hours. They might stay 48 hours, okay, in jail. And when they're done, all of their stuff is there for them. But the chief believes that this would interrupt their lifestyle long enough to get them thinking, do I really want to do this? Do I want to be hauled down to jail once a month, twice a month? You know, it gets them thinking, you know, maybe I need to do something different.
So kind
of believes that that can be successful.
So it's not a financial penalty. It's kind of, for lack of a better word, like a nuisance penalty. Not that they're being a nuisance, but it would be a nuisance in their life pattern.
Yeah, it'd be a nuisance in their life pattern. Since Prop 47, 57, and prison realignment, this is really the same type of nuisance that we've been towards people who want to do breaking and entering. We're not going to get to keep them for a long time, but it still disrupts their game plan and forces them, even if it's for 8 hours or 24 hours, forces them to think, do I really want to continue doing this? So the chief is committed to implementing this policy. That's his call. How they do that, that's the administration and the chief's call. My job is to respond to the overwhelming volume of complaints that I'm getting in my district, people thinking that our city government don't even recognize there's a problem and are unwilling to do anything about it. And I'm saying, no, I'm not going to sit on the fence. I'm going to do something about it.
And I'm familiar with these type of arrangements. I live in central Fresno, and I saw one that the police were breaking up on Shields. So it seems like police are already taking steps to interrupt these smaller homeless encampments.
They are, and they have been. Of course, we started breaking down big encampments several years ago. Now, people throughout the city are doing some of the same things they used to be doing at the big encampments, which was unacceptable then, and so it's unacceptable now. In the past, it was all in one spot and was really a blight on downtown Fresno. Now, we've got many spots, and it's still a blight, and that problem, as I was saying, is not quite a homeless person. But this is not, we're not going after the single mother who lost her job and who's got a hardship. We have great community partners that want to help her. We're also not going off on the veteran who has PTSD. We have great partners who are trying to help him or her. We're going after that obstinate 600 folks that are choosing this lifestyle with a clear mind, and they've been able to work the system. They know what we've been willing to do and not do. So now we're going to call it quits on that enabling. And so I would agree there's times when the police go out and they find a reason to get people moving on. Sometimes that's because they're on private property. They say, hey, you know, you're on somebody's private property. That's considered trespassing. Oh, I get it. I get it. And then they'll move 200-300 yards to another spot under a different bush, and it might be public property. So I'm not saying that nothing's been done. You've been a witness of PD trying to take care of some of these problems in the past, but now we've got to tackle it on a bigger scale.
Anything else you want to add?
You know, I would like to add that this is not, you're not going to see a sweep of people. That's not what this is about. You're not going to see a large-scale assault on a group of people. What you're going to see is just a tool in the toolbox that can be employed on time to time when deemed necessary to break up this behavior. So I want folks, I want your listeners to understand that this is not against any group of people. It's against behaviors that have really been affecting our city. So you're not going to see any sweep. I'm also not naive enough to think that this is going to stop homelessness or, but we're going to add a tool in the toolbox that PD's been asking for and that other communities have found successful. And so we're going to try it here in Fresno.
Steve Brandow, Fresno City Council Member, District 2, thank you very much for your time today.
And thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk to an author of a new book about mega fires and learn why fires are growing more extreme each and every year, not just here in California, but across the globe. That's coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition.
And we thank you for joining us for Valley Edition this morning. I'm John English. I'm the membership manager for Valley Public Radio. We're going to get you back to the news in just a moment. We want to remind you that it's our summer fund drive, our summer membership campaign here at Valley Public Radio. And if news is something you value, we know that you are here because you find the news in a much more thorough, much more valuable way here at Public Radio. So much of what we here build as news coverage these days is actually more like entertainment programming. So many news programs are filled with shouting and bickering and hyperbole, partisan coverage, making drama out of nothing. We know that you turn to FM 89 and NPR to get away from all of that. You turn to us for real journalism without fluff in your community, you know, with multiple perspectives that can help you make up your own mind without trying to make it up for you. You turn to us to learn about new breakthroughs, new ideas, for the stories that are uplifting, telling you about new people, people in your community who are fighting to make something better in the places that we live and work. All of these are reasons that you turn to FM 89, and they're also great reasons to support public radio. You're invested in the way that we approach news coverage at Valley Public Radio, and we hope that you'll invest in it, in keeping it around with your membership support right now. You can go to kvpr.org. You can take a look at all the great options for membership, whether it's sustaining membership on a monthly basis or, a one-time gift of whatever is convenient for your pocketbook. All of it helps to make the programming that you enjoy and that you value possible. It pays the bills. And so we need you to be the next member of Public Radio right now at kvpr.org. And we also have a drawing for everybody who becomes a member during these final couple days of our membership campaign. We are closing up on Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. And so every gift until then will be entered into a drawing to win a summer fun getaway, a two-night stay at a fantastic place over in Cambria called the Blue Dolphin Inn. And if you haven't stayed there before, it is a fantastic, beautiful facility, and we would love to share that with you. Your gift is going to be entered into a drawing to win that, And, you know, we want you to have that opportunity.
Thank you, John English. Don Weaver here, and that's true. We're excited about that as part of our August membership campaign, and we've got that drawing going on through tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, a two-night getaway to the Blue Dolphin Inn. We'll be back to Valley Edition in just a moment. Got some good stuff coming up. Right now, though, we've got a very powerful spot. Ira Glass, our host of This American Life, you can hear that show Wednesdays at 7, Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock, has some very powerful words about public radio, kind of unlike maybe what you've heard before.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And if you're hearing the sound of my voice, chances are you have heard these pledge drives come and you've heard them go year after year, and you have never pledged. That's what statistics say. If you're hearing my voice right now, you probably have never pledged yourself. And I think I may know why. I think that you have noticed that even though you do not pledge personally, somehow this radio station stays on the air. Right? I mean, come on. You hear us say, you got to call, and then you don't call. And the next week, the national programs roll out every day, and you have not given, and Scott Simon and Nina Totenberg somehow do not end up homeless on the street, right? And you have drawn the only possible logical conclusion, which is, it doesn't matter if you call. We will stay on the air. And I'm saying these words, and this is actually the greatest heresy a person can say during the pledge drive. I'm going to say them again right now. It doesn't matter if you call. I want you to remember this moment. You are never going to hear these words again on this radio station during the pledge drive. It doesn't matter if you call. I'm just going to say the absolute truth here. But frankly, I don't think that that is the whole picture. Because although reason tells you that we're going to be fine if you don't call, and reason has dictated your actions during every pledge drive till this point, you've been utterly reasonable. You've followed logic perfectly, right? I'm here to tell you, you got to walk past reason. You got to see reason standing there in the corner, you know, smoking a cigarette and looking all smug, and you're going to walk right past reason. You're going to walk past what is logical and what is reasonable to what is actually a bigger truth, and that is that you want to do what's right. And you know, okay, you know that you listen to this radio station all the time. You're hearing me right now. It's not even a program right now, okay? This isn't a pledge break, okay? That's just how much you listen to this radio station. You listen during the pledge breaks. And what is right? In the simplest way that we teach a five-year-old, you know, here is what's right and here's what's wrong. What is right is that if you use something or depend on something or share something, like you share this radio station with all the other people who listen to this radio station, it is only right to help out and keep it going. If you were to explain this to a five-year-old right now, you would say, that's what's right, and it is not right to let other people, people just like you and me, middle-class people with normal jobs and the same responsibilities that you have and I have, it is not right to let other people shoulder all the burden. You know? So yes, you do not have to pledge. We're going to stay on the air if you don't pledge. Somehow, we're going to come up with the money. And that's why it's such a statement when you walk by the logic of that, the undeniable logic of that, and actually contribute. That's why everybody who contributes the first time, that's why they always say, it felt so good. It felt so good, you know, because it's such an act of faith and community. And, you know, we're all in this together. You know, because the truth is, we are all in this together. You and me and all of us. And that's what you're affirming. Here's how to pledge.
You can pledge online at kvpr.org. There are a number of options for membership with Valley Public Radio there that you can take a look at, as well as some great thank you gifts that we have for you in exchange for your membership support. It is so important, as Ira was saying, to make all of this possible. And, you know, we do come back to you each and every day, and you might have been listening for years and never made that pledge, but we hope that today will be the day that you do it at kvpr.org. You can become a sustaining member on a monthly basis. You can give a one-time gift, whatever works for you. And every gift will be entered into a drawing to win a two-night stay at Cambria's Blue Dolphin Inn. Sustaining members, you're already entered into this drawing automatically. No purchase necessary. The winner will be drawn at the close of the membership campaign. So we would love to hear from you. If you've been thinking about membership for a while, now is the time. Pledge your support online at kvpr.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation is trying out a rule that gives inmates with life sentences the chance to get a lower security classification, which gives them a little more freedom. Capital Public Radio's Sally Schilling went to Solano State Prison to find out if high-level offenders are taking advantage of the opportunity.
California has four different security levels for its prisons. Level one is the lowest, four is the highest. Lieutenant John Ojo says Solano State Prison has levels two and three.
Level two is there's no gun coverage, which is a major difference, and inside are all dorm settings. And level three, it's all cells, and there's gun coverage 24 hours a day.
If you're sentenced to life without possibility of parole, the lowest level you used to be able to transfer down to was a level three, or if you have possibility of parole, down to a level two. Now, California's Corrections Department has decided that these inmates can move down another level if they have good behavior and pass a review. Daniel Hopper, a Latino inmate at Solano, remembers when he moved to a level three. He came from a level four prison where you couldn't use a drinking fountain at the same time as an inmate of another race.
First day there on the yard, I go out and I'm drinking water, and a black guy comes up next to me and starts drinking water. And I remember just like looking and pulling back.
Some other inmates were standing behind him.
They're like, no, you can drink water right now. I was like, with him there? They're like, yeah. Like, you sure? You ain't gonna get me stabbed? And the attitude was, yeah.
Chrissy Kokobashvili with the Corrections Department says it has an obligation to house inmates in the lowest level safely possible. She says California's prisons used to be too overcrowded to attain this goal. But after prison realignment and changes in sentencing laws, they are now able to work on it.
A lot of stuff has happened to where our population has changed, and we no longer have those inmates who are serving really short sentences. So we need to make those opportunities available for people who have the longer sentences.
Nina Salerno with Crime Victims United says the department needs to be more careful in how it deals with these highest level offenders who can pose safety risks to inmates and officers.
There's mostly concerns for the officers inside. I mean, there's a high rate of assault that goes on in prisons, and now you're taking people, especially those life without the possibility of parole, they really have nothing to lose.
Jeff Hall is an inmate on the level three side at Solano. He was sentenced to life without parole for a murder he committed in Santa Clara when he was 18.
I've been in prison for 25 years, believe it or not.
He's participated in numerous prison programs and now leads one called Man Up, a support group that focuses on character building and anger management.
Stand up!
Stand up!
All these years that I've spent, you know, working very, very hard to follow the rules and not get involved in all the nonsense of prison, I find it as a little reward.
When I spoke with Hall in May, he had been granted a transfer to a level two prison and was just waiting for the paperwork to be processed.
The violence, the racial separation, all of that stuff that persists on a level three and a level four, it's really not who I am. Prison has put me in a box I don't want to be in. They're recognizing that just because a person has life without the possibility of parole doesn't necessarily mean that I'm the same person I was when I was 18 to the person now where I'm 43.
The new rule is currently being reviewed and will either be finalized or disapproved later this month. From Sacramento, I'm Sally Schilling.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. In recent years, the Central California summer has brought us wildfires that are growing more and more extreme in their behavior. And just last month, we saw the Detweiler fire in Mariposa double overnight, threatening the city of Mariposa and destroying 63 homes. or last year's Erskine fire in Kern County that destroyed 285 homes. In both cases, veteran fire crews that had been fighting wildland fires for decades said these fires were behaving unlike any they had seen before. It's not an isolated incident. In fact, it's a concern across the West, and it's a specialty of our next guest. Michael Kotas is the Deputy Director of the Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He is the author of the new book, Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. It hits bookstore shelves August 22nd. He joins us now on the phone. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Before we try to explain why we're seeing this change in fire behavior, let's talk about what's actually going on in these fires and how this behavior is different. What exactly is going on here?
Well, you know, as far as fire behavior being different, a lot of what firefighters are seeing are things that they used to be able to count on to help them out on a fire that aren't occurring anymore. For instance, it used to be at most wildfires that at night, when the temperatures cooled, the moisture content of the air increased, that fire behavior would calm down. And very often in California and also here in Colorado and other wildfire-prone areas across the West, they're not seeing that occur anymore. You know, part of what that is due to is climate change and the fact that the temperatures aren't dropping as much at night as they used to, and so you're not seeing the dew point rise to the point where you end up with moisture coming onto these fuels, which is what used to occur to kind of calm down fires at night. And there are other drivers from climate change, from the way we've managed our forests, from the way that we've developed into the woods that have led to things like fires burning downhill rather than uphill, the way that firefighters might anticipate and the way that fires generally behave.
We pay attention to what's happening in California, Colorado, now Montana, what we've seen recently, but I understand this is a global issue.
Yeah, most countries that deal with fires on their landscapes, and that's most countries in the world, are seeing pretty significant changes to what we call fire regimes, which is basically the way that fire behaves on their landscapes. You know, just today there's a fire that is burning into the suburbs in Greece. We've seen horrific fires in Spain and particularly Portugal this year, and we see other megafire behaviors in places like Australia, Indonesia, Southeast Asia. A lot of that is just changes in the way that fires are behaving, how fast they move, the way that they move and respond to weather phenomenon in a way that leaves the people that have been dealing with these fires for a long time at a loss for how to deal with this. You know, they're unprepared for the changes in the way that fires are behaving, and very often they're put in very dangerous situations because fires are doing things that they didn't anticipate.
I understand that for a long time, the term megafire, at least in general, was reserved for blazes over 100,000 acres. You argue, though, that it's time to revisit that.
Yeah, you know, the Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service, has come to define a megafire as a fire of 100,000 acres or more. In the research for my book, which I've been working on for, you know, nearly a decade, I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, there are a lot of small fires that behave unusually, that move faster or in directions that are unanticipated, or are burning so hot that they change things, that are probably more mega than a 100,000-acre fire that's burning in a remote wilderness. A small fire that does things differently than it's done historically and surprises firefighters or residents, maybe destroys a lot of homes, puts our resources at risk, our watersheds at risk, perhaps environments that endangered species depend on, or kills a lot of residents or firefighters, is probably a lot more mega than a huge fire that is burning in a remote wilderness in the same way that it's always burned in remote wildernesses like that.
How are tactics changing in response to this? Certainly we saw the Yarno Hill tragedy a few years ago where a number of firefighters lost their lives in a very tragic situation. Are there creative responses now to this other than simply forest management?
There are the firefighters, that work in forests and in wildland fire are constantly changing their tactics and trying to make things safer. The challenge is that they're having to deal with fires that are much more aggressive very often and also have a lot more values at risk that they can affect. So, there's also an incentive to do more to stop these fires. One thing that has started to happen in the last decade is the idea of having multiple objectives so that you can have a wildfire that we don't just have the attitude we're just, we have to put out that fire. Instead, we think a little more precisely that on these fronts where it's perhaps threatening a community or a watershed, we really need to aggressively fight this fire. But on these other fronts, on these other flanks where it's burning into a huge national forest, we might be able to let it burn in that direction. And actually, fires become self-regulating. So by letting that fire burn, it's probably going to make the next fire in that area less severe. And very often, fires are beneficial to, our remote forests and our large forests. Many animals depend on burnt forests for habitat and for food. And it makes that forest much more efficient as a watershed, as a way of purifying air and water and things like that. It's important to recognize in all of this that fire is as much a part of our forested landscapes as rain, and our forests need fire to be healthy.
So we keep hearing about that very issue, forest management and the consequences of years of fire suppression activities that reinforce that. This is not a new thing, though. We've heard about this for decades. Why is it that we're still dealing with this legacy, this problem? Is it that implementing changes in forest management is difficult, or is it just we're going to be with this for the next 100 years because it was close to a century of that sort of tactic?
There are a few things at play there. And one is that as we have improved our science and our studies of forests and wildfire, we've realized that no situation is universal across the United States or even across the West. So we do have many forests that, due to a century of fire suppression, ended up with many times their natural fuel load, and a number of those forests are showing much more severe wildfires due to the buildup of fuels from us putting out fires in a forest that may be burned every 10 or 20 years. Obviously, if you have a forest that naturally burns every 20 years and you put out every fire in that forest for a century, you're going to have at least five times more fuel in that forest than you would naturally. But many other forests, that's not the case. Some that burn regularly but still were prone to large, intense fires even without our suppression activities. And then other forests, like, say, lodgepole pine forests, that burn every 100 to 300 years in what we call stand-reducing fires. They almost always burn in really intense wildfires, and in fact, that tree is dependent on really intense wildfires to reproduce. So putting out fires in that forest for a century when it only burned every 200 or 300 years probably didn't change the structure of that forest very much. In those forests where our forest management, and that can be from putting out too many fires, it can be from planting things in those forests that then decades later mature to be something that changes the way fires behave there. It can be from the way that we develop in those forests. In those forests, it's imperative that we get fire back into them in some way that mimics the way that fire behaved there naturally. But that's very difficult once we've overfueled those forests through fire suppression or introducing species in them. It's very complicated to try to put fire back on the ground in a forest in the way that it burned there 100 years ago when we've got 5 or 10 times more fuel in that forest than we used to have. So it's a very dangerous proposition. Prescribed burns and fires managed by firefighters have become a really critical and important part of what we do with forest management in the West, but it's also a very complicated and difficult process, both because of the perils of reintroducing fires to those forests, and also because, you know, we've developed all around these forests and into these forests, and so we have a population there that is not thrilled about the idea of us intentionally setting fires in these forests, or are often sensitive to the smoke. Most states require that prescribed burns, you know, burns managed by foresters and firefighters are only done when the smoke won't impact the population, when it's, you know, not going to threaten species that live in the area. It becomes almost as complicated to reintroduce fire into these forests as it was to create a policy to put out the fires in these forests that, you know, we put together a century ago.
How well equipped is the U.S. Forest Service, which is responsible for a lot of these wildfires? How well equipped are they to deal with the forest fires that are burning in the national forests? Is there a cultural disconnect there? Has there been progress? Because we hear a lot of criticism in these parts from some people who are admittedly in the middle of a crisis often when we hear this criticism. But what's your evaluation of the state of the Forest Service's fire response program?
Certainly the U.S. Forest Service is probably the most advanced and prepared organization in the world to deal with wildfires and to deal with megafires. That said, they are often completely overwhelmed by the nature of these fires, and a lot of that is often because there are so many of them burning simultaneously. You know, once a fire gets to be really, really big, you can try to herd it a little bit, you can try to protect certain resources, but it's going to do what it's going to do, and I don't think there's any suppression resource in the world that's going to be able to just come and snuff that fire. When you then consider the fact that you may have 5 or 10 fires burning like that in the country, and you're having to share resources from the Forest Service, from the Department of Interior, et cetera, throughout the country, it becomes an incredibly difficult puzzle. And so, you know, I'm not sure that any organization is up to that challenge when we see a really big fire year. One measure of the way that this has affected the Forest Service and how overwhelming this is to the Forest Service is simply to look at their budget. You know, in 1995, I believe it was about 16% of the Forest Service budget that went to wildfires. And in 2015, it was 52% of the Forest Service budget that went to dealing with wildfires. And because of those costs, which are escalating all the time due to the changes in the nature of fire on our landscapes, the Forest Service, more often than not, and more fire seasons than not, runs out of money to fight wildfires. And, you know, come August or September, you know, particularly when Southern California is just getting into the worst part of its season, the U.S. Forest Service has often run out of money to fight wildfires. And, of course, they're still going to fight them, but they've got to get that money somewhere else. And very often what they have to do is get that money from other programs that would help to make forests more resilient to wildfire. So they end up gutting programs to reintroduce fire to forests where it's safe to do that, or to thin forests, or for wildfire protection plans, or various other operations, as well as recreation. And by, you know, moving all of that money into fire suppression, we leave ourselves vulnerable to worse fires in the future.
Is it safe to say this is a problem that is here to stay? We all know the looming threat of global warming and the compound effect that you've talked about with these fires. Is there any ray of hope with this issue of megafires, or are we just going to see this continue to grow?
Well, I've got two answers to that question, and the first is probably a little scarier than the second. The first is, you know, in 2015, that year I cited where the Forest Service, spent 52% of its budget on wildfires, that was the first year on record since the U.S. has been keeping records that we had more than 10 million acres burn in the nation. Now, prior to development of the West, we probably had years with more acres than that burning, but of course that's before we had roads and all kinds of resources at risk, and before we were spending upwards of $3 billion on wildfire in this nation. So that was 10 million acres in 2015. Around the same time, Forest Service scientists put out a report that anticipated that within a few decades, a bad fire year will see 20 million acres burn in the United States. That's an area nearly the size of the state of Maine burning in a bad fire year in the U.S. So it's not that the fire problem is here to stay. It's that it is increasing rapidly, and there's very little that we can do to actually prevent bigger, more, and more destructive wildfires. So, but the other side of that is, there is a bit of a ray of hope in that we as individuals and as a government will start to think less about fighting wildfire and thinking more about how do we live with wildfire. And so, we're seeing more and more people and developments being much more thoughtful about where they build, where they put in resources and infrastructure, where we build our homes. And that's not to say that we can't live in wooded landscapes or, deep in the forest, but that we need to be a lot smarter about how we live in places like that. And we're also starting to see a recognition on the part of both our government and of just the individual landowners that fire is a necessary part of our forested landscapes. And so they're learning not just to live with it, but how do we have fire on these landscapes in a way that's going to be most beneficial to me, most beneficial to the forest overall, most beneficial to the various species that live in this landscape. So I do think that we're starting to think about fire in a much more positive way in response to the rapidly increasing threat that we're looking at.
Michael Kotis is the deputy director at the Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He is the author of the new book, Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. It hits store shelves nationwide August 22nd. Joining us today on Valley Edition. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. Leading a healthy life is about much more than being able to see a doctor or get into a hospital. It's also about access to fresh foods, places to go for exercise, and things like safe parks. That's a major struggle for many people in communities throughout the Central Valley. A new report from the advocacy organization Building Healthy Communities and Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State says hospitals should be doing more to improve what they call neighborhood health. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with the report's author, Tanya Pacheco-Werner, about what she found, how a healthy neighborhood can actually keep people out of the hospital, and why it's an incumbent, in her view, that hospitals do more to improve the quality of life in poor communities.
And so part of the nexus of the study is what hospitals can do in the community to improve health. It's connected to funding from the Affordable Care Act. What did you find that hospitals could actually be doing?
As a way to continue to enjoy this health, this favorite tax status of not-for-profit, there are these opportunities for care that is culturally responsive within hospital walls, that attends to people's language barriers, but then also what they actually can have access to once they are told to access preventive services or eat better or exercise more. Outside of the hospital walls, there is this opportunity to invest in this, what we call the built environment, which is the idea of when I walk out of my house, what do I see, what's around me, what air am I breathing, and what am I seeing as opportunities for me to be healthy.
Why is it the hospital's responsibility to make sure that there are enough parks or safe parks, or that there is enough fruits and or fresh grocery stores? Why should the hospitals be taking that lead and not the city?
So in the 1990s, the IRS made very clear to hospitals that when they enjoy this not-for-profit status, and the idea of community benefit is not to benefit only their direct patients, and thus not only direct patient care. So they do have a responsibility to the community at large and to do what we call community good.
Well, and I would think, too, if a doctor is trying to care for somebody, you can't just give them advice and send them out into a community that doesn't have the the type of support that a patient can follow that advice.
When I talk to physicians, no physician wants to set up a patient to fail. And what this report does is it really highlights some unique places where doctors can have this conversation of, I want you to exercise better, and I know that the program next door at Gaston Middle School at 6 o'clock is just for 60-plus-year-olds like you to get some exercise in. So I hope you can go there, right? To have that really direct understanding of what's actually available for people to achieve these health goals.
And that's kind of my overarching question for you, is a lot of these concerns, a lot of people from Fresno know. They know that Southeast and Southwest Fresno have a lack of safe parks. They have a lack of grocery stores. So I'm interested, what are the recommendations? What are the things that you think from this report that hospitals should be doing?
I think one, there's a unique opportunity to partner with not-for-profit organizations, but also FQHCs, so federally qualified health centers, that are trying to do some of this innovative work to see, okay, if there's limited funding, right, because everything is about funds, I can augment this program that's going on in Central Fresno that Clinica Sierra Vista has. In this model, I can make 20 of these if all of our hospitals join together and have this one common investment. And so the recommendation is really to listen to residents, listen to the community organizations, and leverage what's already there, the opportunities, like with the Parks Master Plan in the city of Fresno, like with the Downtown Neighborhood Partnership, like all of these city of Fresno plans that are coming up. There's an opportunity for that not-for-profit hospital partnership with cities and with non-for-profit organizations to really work together to solve these issues of inequality of the built space in South Fresno.
Well, and I think you just hit on like the nexus of the issue, which is it really is, it's a money thing. We hear this all the time. Like, we could build more parks if we had the money. It's two sides of the same coin, which is, yeah, it might be a money issue, but you also get healthier patients if you go ahead and step and take your care out of your hospital building into the community at large.
It's that nexus between that looking at investments, one, as a requirement of this not-for-profit status, but two, as an opportunity to make care that doesn't rely on reimbursement rates, right? Think about healthcare as having places for people to learn how to cook and provide physical activity, right? So it's really being able to look at health care beyond what happens inside the walls of a hospital.
It was Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess speaking with Tania Pacheco-Werner, the author of a new report for the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State that says hospitals should be doing more to improve health in communities throughout California. Stay with us. More of Valley Public Radio coming up in our membership campaign, but that does it for Valley Edition. We'd like to thank you for joining us today and remind you that you can send us your comments about the program, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet. We're at KVPR and at Valley Edition. You can find our audio archives and podcast online as well, kvpr.org, and find our program information and ways that you can support Valley Public Radio with your membership gift. Again, that's kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.